From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Jack Hitt has a book that profiles the American amateur, the people who fiddle with cars and robots and all kinds of stuff in their garages and backyards. He identifies the aspects of this country that have created so many amateurs and how so many amateurs have given the country its energy and creativity. Hitt says American history is bound up in a cycle of amateur surges, and often these surges happen when times are rough. David Packard created Hewlett-Packard in his garage in the middle of the Depression. Steve Jobs went into his garage during the days of high inflation in the 70s. So it wouldn't be a stretch to think that in today's shaky economy, there's another surge on the horizon. Jack Hitt will join us today to explain how amateurs and their fiddling tend to point us to the next uncharted region. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jack Hitt has written a book that profiles the American amateur, the people who fiddle around with cars and robots and all kinds of things in their garages and their backyards. Mostly these are people who live on the fringes of institutions and establishments, but they've always been a part of American life, driving innovation and success. In the book, Hitt identifies the aspects of this country that have created so many amateurs and how so many amateurs have given the country its energy and creativity. Hitt says the country's history is bound up in a cycle of these kinds of amateur surges, and there may be another one brewing. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about the book. It's called Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. Jack Hitt is a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, This American Life as well. He also writes for Rolling Stone, GQ, and Garden and Gun. He's written a solo theater performance called Making Up the Truth. Jack Hitt joins us today from a studio in Charleston, South Carolina. And Jack Hitt, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
I wanted to start with this conversation you apparently had with a book editor. You were having lunch, and he said that he had noticed that a lot of your stories had this character, this self-invented crank that had some kind of obsession or some kind of grand idea, that your stories were packed with these things. Had you noticed that when he mentioned it?
I honestly hadn't. You know, and he just started like listing off these pieces that I'd written over the years. And, you know, his idea was to put them all together in a kind of Jack Hitt reader or something. And, you know, I thought, well, that's great. I'm not sure I have arrived at some threshold where anybody is clamoring for a Jack Hitt reader. But I did like the idea that, I mean, I totally recognized what he was saying, that I am, in fact, you know, quite, you know, blatantly attracted to these characters. And and they often figure in some way in my stories. And in fact, at the moment that he was, you know, telling me this, I was under assignment with the Times to do a piece that eventually was entitled The Amateur Future of Space Travel. And it was about a number of different contests that NASA holds that it tries to attract backyard amateurs into helping them invent cheaper and better technologies that will perpetuate our sort of, you know, space exploration. Yeah. And so I latched onto this guy, Brian Turner, in Kansas and started writing about him. And I loved hanging out with these guys, literally in a garage, trying to invent beam power.
This is
this is an idea where you would shoot like a laser beam up to sort of a solar panel on a plane, and that would be its fuel source. So it would carry no fuel.
Yeah.
So you would manage, the plane would weigh almost half as much as it does now. You'd be able to fly great distances. Of course, there's this terrifying idea that there would be no fuel on board. a little in emergency, maybe some emergency fuel. Yeah. But still, the idea was so great. And here were these like backyard inventors fooling around with this. And so rather than put together a reader, I just started almost from scratch and just started reporting newer and, you know, more contemporaneous stories.
But what do you figure it is about these characters that that is so appealing for you? I mean, one of the things that you get throughout the book is that you do actually hang out with them. I mean, you really kind of like them. And I wonder, what's the thing that is so appealing about them?
Well, I think there's something really inspiring, even patriotic, about this crazy impulse that really, I mean, I know it's all over the world, but I think it's especially here and it sort of defines our character. But this idea that you can walk out your back door and into a garage and invent a new future. You know, it's for whatever reason that became part of our DNA almost from the beginning. You know, actually, well, from the beginning, since I write about that.
Yeah.
And you know, that impulse, I mean, it's a great sort of, it's the immigrant narrative in miniature, right? I mean, this whole country is founded really by people who were driven out of their homelands or, you know, expelled or dragged here against their will. I mean, you know, we've created these lovely sort of propaganda narratives about how our ancestors came here for liberty and religious freedom. Well, that's nice, but it's often not true.
Yeah.
What's more likely true is that even if you were a Puritan, you know, you were driven out of England because they thought Puritans were terrorists and extremists, right? Slaves were dragged here against their will, and most of our ancestors who weren't slaves were indentured servants, also brought here against their will. So, you know, there's a whole sort of sense of reinvention of character in almost all of our ancestors. They were either forced or chose to create a new persona, often taking a new name, a new idea of self, a new family history, and of course, landing on new terrain. So it was easier to, this whole idea of beginning from scratch, which is the essence of the amateur pursuit, really is sort of born in our DNA because we're so many of us come here with an immigrant narrative, you know? And in some ways, I think that walk to the garage is kind of a recapitulation of the essential American story.
Yeah. There's this scene that you set in the book early on. This is May of 1778. It's in Paris. And this is 1778. Mm-hmm. And this takes place in front of these ornate gates in Versailles, and the American founder, John Adams, is going to meet the king. And he's there essentially to see if France is going to help support the colonial army. And he's I'm sort of imagining him sort of tapping his toe, right? Jack Kidd is
waiting.
He's waiting for Benjamin Franklin. Tell the story.
So, first of all, Adams had been sent over to Paris to check in on Ben,
right.
Who, remember now, Ben is 50 years older than most of the founding fathers. We lump them all together, right? But it would be like if you and I decided to start a revolution and we somehow drafted, I don't know, Stephen Hawking, right, to be one of our, you know, part of our cohort, right? I mean, here's this really famous guy who's, you know, a good deal older than us, perhaps, and already well established. And we're like 28, 30 years old or something. And you know, have no connection to this guy whatsoever. He is a genius. He's the man who tamed lightning.
Yeah.
He's already world famous when he goes to Paris. And so, and of course, the founding fathers also thought that Ben was this big party boy and, you know, a lecher and a drinker, right?
Yeah.
We can argue that later.
Yeah, but anyway, we'll come back around to it. Yeah, but
we'll come back to that. So Adams is sent over there really to sort of just kind of watchdog this guy.
Yeah.
And when he gets there, you know, Franklin won't even talk to him. He won't meet. He sends letters saying, like, I'm way too busy, John. Sorry, we'll have to meet later. We'll meet at the gates of Versailles when you go in to meet the king, right? And so here's the other thing you have to know about Ben at this point. When he got off his boat, he just happened to have like a coonskin cap to keep his old bald head warm. Mm. And he noticed that people really reacted to it. Mm. And of course, he's the one who first realized that in 1778, the French were looking at us differently than they ever had before.
Yeah.
Because before, we were just British citizens. But now, we were something else. We were something called an American.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the question was, well, what is that?
Yeah.
And he noticed that people were reacting to this kind of like crazy costume that he happened to just have along for the ride to keep himself warm.
Wait, you mentioned this. You have to say this because you established this in the book that there is this. There's this fight. There's this debate going on in Paris about the nature of man.
That's right.
What kind of man is living in this new world? Because these scientists are talking about in Europe are figuring that the American climate is creating kind of this different strain of human being.
That's right. It was a very – in fact, it was a scientific fact in 1778 that the vapors of North America made men smaller and weaker, more impotent. Yeah. Our women were more – were less fertile and could barely, you know, provide for their children. Our animals were thinner and produced less milk and frailer and often died young. It was a scientific fact that the way a North American snake dined was to lie on its back, unhinge its jaw, and wait for one of our spastic squirrels to just tumble into its mouth.
Right.
I think it was also like a bears fed by cutting a hole in the side of a cow and blowing into it until it exploded and then collecting the meat. I mean, it was just these crazy ideas about how North America worked. And one of my favorite scenes earlier than 1778 is Franklin is at some dinner party with some other Americans and some French intellectuals. And this subject comes up. Mm. And at one point, Franklin asks all the Americans to stand up. And of course, Franklin was 6 feet something. Yeah. And so were the other Americans by chance at the table. And so they all stood up and they're looking down on these like puny little Gaelic intellectuals. And he's like, what are you talking about? Where does this come from, this idea that we're just a bunch of little, you know, emaciated homunculi sitting in the woods of North America? Anyway, Franklin, wonderful character. So he's wearing this coonskin cap running around at the time when everybody thinks that Americans are, you know, not only just these weak sort of like imperfect vessels, but also that there was something primal about us. That because we sort of lived in the woods and cut down the trees for the first time and cleared land, that we were sort of, you know, like Adam and Eve practically, that we were just starting anew. And Voltaire and others, you know, Rousseau wrote about the natural man and the idea that even our religions just bloomed out of this kind of organic, you know, nothingness. And it was all beautiful, or if you believe the intellectuals, horrible, you know, weak, infernal. So Franklin realizes that this coonskin cap is really playing well in France because people think this frontierman, the Davy Crockett character, right, is like this kind of something, there's something very essential about it. And he starts just swanning about town in this crazy costume all the time. All right. So I love this image of Adams, who was a very proper man and lived by the rules and wrote constant letters to Abigail. Anybody who's read them know that Adams was, you know, he spent a certain hour of every day and just read Latin. He set aside another hour every day and read like great literature. He was this very disciplined, orderly man. Yeah.
He's a Puritan.
And so when he gets to, he's a Puritan, right. And so when he gets to the gates of Versailles, he, of course, is in the expected apparel of a man approaching the King of France. And by the way, in those days, they had these, like, rent a knight's outfit shops right there at the gates of Versailles, like you would go rent a prom suit if you're a teenager, right? A tuxedo. So Adams, you know, has a sword, and you have the waistcoat, and you have these, you know, wig. You know, you have the sort of Baroque lacy collars and all this business. He's all dressed up, and I like to imagine Ben showing up in his wagon and hopping out, and he's got on like shredded boots and a weight, you know, and a buckskin jacket and this stupid coonskin cap, right? Looking for all the world to see like Davy Crockett. And understand too that Ben is probably the only person in North America at the time who could possibly be counted as a sophisticate anyway. Yeah. He is the least likely person that you would see in this outfit. And I like to imagine John Adams looking at him like, what? What are you doing? We're going to see the King of France. And Ben sort of looking at him and saying, John, you don't get it, do you?
Yeah.
This is who they think we are. This is how we're going to get the money. And of course, it's how we got the money.
Yeah, we got the money.
got the money and the arms and Lafayette.
Exactly. But you say it's kind of that moment that marked, I guess in some way, kind of like the birth of the American character in some way.
Of course, these things, it's, you know, you can make your case for where the sort of the idea of the American character begins. But I want to locate it there because I just love that story. And by the way, Franklin realized that he was suddenly the center of like what might arguably be the first media circus. People painted his likeness with that coonskin cap on like snuff boxes and made portraits of it. In fact, the guy he was living with was sort of this cheesy promoter of the day, the Don King of 18th century France. And he organized all this promotional stuff. Adams wrote constantly about how much he hated this, and the idea of the public man was this kind of dissolute, horrible thing. The way you and I might complain about cable TV, you know, he complained about Ben Franklin that way. And it's like, oh, my God, it's just so vulgar and god-awful, and, you know, you know, it's all lies and whatever. And so he wrote about Franklin this way. But Franklin, of course, used this media circus to advance the American case. That was what was so great. And in the course of that, realizing that they were all looking at him for the first time as an American, put on this character of this kind of starting from scratch frontier man who's like carving everything anew, right? That idea of him as the tinkerer, the man who went into his back shop and discovered lightning, you know, or discovered, you know, the bifocal and the Franklin stove and, you know, the fire department and the lending library and all that stuff we grew up learning, that kind of essential character is Ben Franklin in 1778. And that character sort of becomes this sort of mixed in with the idea of what an American, in fact, is. Yeah.
Jack Hitt is with us. His book is called Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Jack Hitt is with us to talk about America's amateurs. These are people driven by a sense of passion and joy for all kinds of things, biology, robotics, bird watching. His book is called Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. So I wanted to talk to you about the story of the ivory-billed woodpecker. But start the story, if you would, the way it came to you. I guess this was 2005, and this revelation is coming out that after 60 years, an ivory-billed woodpecker was discovered in the swamps of Arkansas. And you had heard about the story before it broke. And in fact, you talk about how you sort of saw the story break.
Right. I'd never paid attention to something like that before, in part because, you pick up the paper and then stories start to happen. But in this case, a friend of mine involved in birding, professional birding, called me a couple of, days, if not weeks, before the official sighting, when no one knew it except for a handful of people, including people inside the Bush administration. This is 2005.
Yeah.
And he said, like, do you want the biggest story of the century? I was like, sure. He says, can you keep a secret? I was like, yeah, I think I can if it's the biggest story of the century. And understand that no one has seen this very beautiful sort of charismatic bird since World War II, but it's been much hunted for since then. And there have been all sorts of like rumors and theories that it might still exist somewhere in Cuba, some parts of Southeast America and so on. And so he told me, he said, they have found the ivory-billed woodpecker. It's been spotted in a swamp in Arkansas, and I can get you in and you can be one of the inside people to break this story. Well, I was, of course, yeah, I can't wait, and then I think, as I was preparing to, doing my homework and reading up on it, I remember waking up one morning and turning on the radio and there was, Don Gagne or somebody, on NPR, like, I'm in the swamps of Arkansas. I could hear the canoe paddling through the water. And it's like, I have given inside access to the ivory-billed woodpecker sighting. I was like, oh, wait a minute. So, of course, everybody on this team had called their favorite journalist and said, I got a hot story for you. Anyway, whoever it was at NPR, they got there first. But it was on the front page of every major newspaper. You've never seen a new truth declared with such pageantry and sort of officialdom outside of like ancient Rome. I mean, it was this huge stage in Washington. The Department of the Interior head was there. The Bush administration promised some $10 million in, ecosystem rehabilitation or rehab money. And there was the much credentialed official ornithologist, John Fitzpatrick, who was the head of the most official, sort of outlet of ornithology that there is, something called the Cornell University Lab of Ornithology.
Yeah.
And Fitz, as he's known, made this great announcement that they had found the bird after much, searching, and they had scientifically confirmed the bird. They had seven official sightings by, PhD ornithologists. They had a video. They had recorded sounds of the bird and all sorts of other minor evidence that the bird existed in this one swamp, appropriately called the Big Woods in Arkansas. And so what could be better, right? And there was great jubilation. And as I say in the book, I mean, I think this bird sort of arrived back in American consciousness with about as much mythic force as, say, Noah's dove returning to the ark.
Yeah.
There was some sense in which that this seeing this bird and just the way everybody was promoting it from Cornell to the Bush administration seemed to suggest that maybe we hadn't been so terrible, environmentally speaking. He was this disappeared bird suddenly back, resurrected to life. It all happened around Easter, by the way. I mean, so the whole thing just kind of, oh, and by the way, you know, the bird itself, one of its nicknames is the Lord God Bird.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so there was a sort of wonderful convergence of images and hope and literature, everything kind of came together and created this brand new truth.
Yeah.
That there it is, the ivory-billed woodpecker for everybody to see.
Well, right? And you see it as this, you describe it as in the book as this kind of case study of, you have on one hand professionals, right, who are using the media,
right,
and they're using all of the tools of a modern age to proclaim this truth.
Right.
And then you have the outsiders who start to raise these questions and start, but they don't have access to the same tools that the pros have. So they have to come,
right,
at sort of challenging the story in a different way.
Right. So, for example, the first person to really crack, to crack the hard shell of this new truth was David Sibley, who all you birders know is the greatest bird painter on the earth.
Right.
He is a Cornell dropout and whatnot, but more importantly, he's just an observer of birds, a very close observer, but he's not an ornithological scientist like the folks at Cornell. But one of the things that Sibley is, of course, better at than anybody in the world is how to spot a bird on the fly. Hmm. I mean, I've been out with him, and it's an amazing thing to see. The minute a bird comes within view of him, he throws his binoculars up to his eyes, and like this kind of cone of silence descends, you know, all around him.
Yeah.
And you just sort of feel it like, oh my God, you know, this guy who has spent his whole life looking at birds is now looking at a bird,
right,
and I am here to witness it.
Right.
You know, you almost feel like I spent more time looking at him whenever I'd go birding with him than I would at anything else. But of course, he looked at the video,
yeah,
and what he saw was this very different thing than what the expert saw. He saw a common pileated woodpecker performing this rather agitated wing beat movement when you push off of a tree. Oh, let me back up. The video is just a few seconds long. In fact, I don't even think it's 2 seconds long.
Yeah.
And it's blurred because the bird is in the far distance. But the bird is pushing off of a tree and doing those first sort of big scoops of a wing beat to get airborne and then flies away from the camera. So all you see are those first couple of, you know, wing beats. And what Sibley argues is that what you're seeing is the twisted wings of a pileated that in that 1 or 2 second set of frames look like an ivory-billed woodpecker.
Yeah.
And so he asks the scientific question, what is more likely, that a common pileated is twisting its wings in a funny way or that we've seen an ivory-billed woodpecker? And all of a sudden, every birder in America went, oh my God, it's a mistake.
Yeah.
But that was just the beginning. Then there was a blogger named Tom Nelson, who was an amateur birder himself. And he started just sort of hosting all these complaints from amateur birders who just started to pile on. And basically every stick of evidence that Cornell had mounted to show that they had seen an ivory-billed woodpecker started to fall apart under the avalanche of really brilliant amateur observations about how these kind of isolated experts in their fortress of expertise who now spent most of their days behind computers looking at, like, you know, reproductive rates and data sets from all kinds of observations, but they weren't really observers anymore.
Yeah.
Even though they were the experts, the real heirs to the old birder tradition of 100 years ago when, you know, birders went into the woods and, you know, killed the birds and then painted them, or killed the birds and collected them, right? That era is now over. But that sort of on the ground sort of, you know, really primal, you know, tactile interface with the bird, that's now left up to the amateurs, to the field guides, to the painters, to all the people outside the great fortress of expertise that is, say, in this case, Cornell. And so the reason I wrote about it is just because it's such a beautiful case where expertise has this way of sort of cutting itself off from the very thing in a way that it's assigned to do. And then people who aren't overly specialized or overly caught up in the sort of conventional wisdom of a discipline can kind of stand outside that and say, you know, I think you have this wrong. I think there are other ways to think about this thing, whatever that is, just as an aside. In the last 10 years, you know, my profession, your profession, journalism, has been, all of the fortresses of expertise have been besieged by bloggers.
Yeah.
And, you know, that has been nothing but good for journalism because, let's face it, especially a lot of the official organs in Washington, D.C. have become just like publicity agents for people in power. And I don't say that like in some extreme way. They literally don't like to say anything that an official in power won't say for them.
Yeah.
You know, they will tell you this. They think that's wrong, that their job is to repeat what position people in power say. But bloggers don't care about that.
Yeah.
They're kind of like Ben Franklin. They're just, you know, improvising. All right. And just writing these kind of things that don't look like news articles or whatever they are, posts. Right. And of course, you know, 10 years ago, I don't know if you remember this, it was just these nonstop conferences about blogging and this great worrying and everything. Now I think we are all over it. And it's like, yeah, blogging, a great new journalistic tradition
right.
on the way in. Right.
Well, because they're the grunts in the field, right?
They're the grunts in the field, right? And they're the ones that are willing to go stand in, you know, in some place that, you know, and look at things that journalists are too wealthy and busy to do, right? Official journalists. They're willing to go stand in a press conference for 5 hours if they have to and wait until they can ask some, you know, a rude question. And they also don't mind troubling people of power. They don't mind afflicting the comforted, as we used to say, the comfortable, as we used to say, because they've got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
And so there's something really liberating about that kind of freedom. And that's what I write about here, too, is that these birders, you know, they don't have an entire graduate school of ornithology to fret about. They're just looking at the video, and the video doesn't really look very good. And by the way, every stick of evidence that Cornell threw up to say we've seen this bird has now been absolutely debunked by everybody except for a handful of people at Cornell
yeah.
who still cling to this idea that – and they now officially say, well, maybe we saw one ivory-billed woodpecker and it went away. Okay. You know, that sounds really like a very lame justification for what is probably more truly that you – got caught up in a kind of emotional bubble where everybody was on the same team on the secret mission out in the swamps of Arkansas, saw what was clearly a pileated numerous times, misidentified it as a you know, ivory bill, and got caught up in your own kind of hype.
Well, wait, you went out there, and it's interesting because you were with this guy named Bill Tippett, and you see
right.
what he thinks is an ivory bill. You just see something flapping off into the distance. Did you get caught up in it for a moment? I mean, did you feel at all tempted to say, yeah, no, I saw one?
Well, I did. But, you know, the minute Bill said he saw it, and by the way, the tradition in birding is when someone sees something like this or spots a bird, he calls out like all the markings and other observations he has about what he saw.
Yeah.
And the friend writes that down, right? That becomes kind of part of the official record. And we called it in on a cell phone right then and there.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote it all down,
yep.
you know, that he saw a blast of white trailing feathers. You know, he saw the way the bird flew through the air, you know, this kind of thing. But what he didn't see, and almost nobody ever saw, was the white bill, the ivory bill.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the pileated has a black bill. And here's one of the tricky things, and one of the reasons why I immediately suspected that we hadn't really seen an ivory bill, although I didn't say anything, is that, you know, if you see one of the absolutely confirming things that's unambiguous, like the ivory bill, then you know you've seen an ivory bill.
Right.
So all the evidence that people tended to report would be like the blast of white underfeathers and this kind of stuff. Well, you know, the pileateds have that too, depending on how they're twisting their wings and this kind of thing. So it's very easy to get kind of confused about some of the more ambiguous evidence. But the rock solid evidence, we never saw that. And one of the things that the amateurs in the blog pointed out, which I thought was brilliant, was that, you know, all of these sort of like emotional bubbles all have common elements of proof. A fuzzy video.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, what do we know about Bigfoot or Loch Ness?
Right.
Fuzzy picture.
Yeah.
Right? Why is it a fuzzy picture? Because if it were any more clear, then you would see that it's not a Bigfoot. It's a bear kind of with its head twisted funny and walking in some odd way that kind of gives you just enough sort of cognitive ambiguity to impose on the picture what you want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Loch Ness. If it were any more focused, you'd see it was like a stick in the water. But it's out of focus, and so you can sort of see like this dinosaur head. And they all tend to have these elements, right? The sound also, you know, was easily debunked as you know, there's a for example, there's a double knock that the bird does. It's a very fast, like two knocks, one after the other. And then someone pointed out that, you know, a truck at a distant interstate running over like a manhole cover can create the exact acoustic register of the double knock of the ivory bill. So, you know, so there's all sorts of ways in which all of these sort of proofs end up being just the kind of ambiguous stuff that allows you to impose on the frail evidence in front of you sort of what it is you want to see. And once Bill described to me all of his evidence and I realized, oh, this all falls into that kind of ambiguous kind of, you know, evidence. But here's the thing, too. Like, we came back to, you know, the central camp where everybody was, and he was, you know, telling people that he had seen an ivory bill woodpecker. But I could say that. You know, I saw the bird that he saw. Yeah. I could actually claim I had seen one. And I don't know. It felt so wrong. Even if I did believe that it was an ivory bill woodpecker, it seemed like this rare, precious thing to be able to claim. And I just felt unworthy, you know, of the honor of having seen one. And in fact, when I would talk to other people about it, they all sort of shared that idea that they felt unworthy of making the claim, except for the experts at Cornell. And I think that was another one of those clues that something was all wrong here. No one felt really comfortable, like just eagerly like grabbing that brass ring and saying, yeah, I saw it, you know?
It's interesting that the parallels you draw between, you know, the rollout of this story and the Bush administration trying to make the case to invade Iraq, and this question of how truth sort of plays out in, you know, in the minds of the media and the public too.
Well, you know, I didn't make that comparison. The birders did.
Yeah.
The amateurs were, because all of that was happening while this was happening. So, Rick Prom, a fantastic and well credentialed ornithologist at Yale University, and actually one of the first people to signal that there was something wrong, although he never published his findings. But Rick was the one who said that the ivory bill woodpecker is the WMD of ornithology, right? That all the people who wanted to see it saw it right where it was. And all the people who were trying to look at it objectively were scratching their heads going, what are we doing? There are no weapons of mass destruction there. What are you talking about? But we invaded anyway. And in a funny way, that's what we did with the ivory bill woodpecker. We took money away from legitimate endangered species that were being whose research was being funded, because that's what happened at the Department of the Interior. They defunded actual existing endangered species and redirected it to the non-existent ivory bill woodpecker. An amazing act of modern bureaucratic incompetence.
Well, I guess the sort of point then is that amateurs are more likely to see what's actually there then, because as you say in the book, there's no money there, there's no power there, there's no prestige attached to seeing anything but what's actually there.
That's right. I mean, there's a number of different things that amateurs get to see. Well, first of all, let me just back up and say, amateurs are often very amateurish, and they get it all wrong.
Yeah.
In fact, I have a whole chapter in there about, you know, about anthropology where the amateurs just sort of run right off the rails.
Yeah.
But that said, there is a kind of lovely freedom of being able to wander about a subject as widely or as narrowly as you choose, because there's no payday for you. You're under no pressure to get to some point. And the one thing about paid research is that, you know, there has to be a kind of stated goal. It's like any kind of grant application. You have to tell them what you're going to find before you find it, or you're going to be fired. That's how paid research works. So one of the advantages that amateurism has is that you can spend, you know, well, in some cases, a lifetime not finding the sort of the goal that you're looking for. But often that playfulness and the kind of liberty of being in your garage and thinking like, I think I'll wander down this road. It might take a year to figure out what's down that road. But you feel like, hey, it's my place. It's my workshop. I can do this. And it becomes a pleasure all the way down the road. You know, we can talk about there was some time I spent with a synthetic biologist.
Yeah, we'll do that right when we get back from a break.
Great.
Meredith Peterson,
sure.
She's a great character. Yeah. Jack Hitt is with us. Bunch of Amateurs, the name of his book, A Search for the American Character. We'll take a break. This is Radio West on KUWR and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back with Jack Hitt. We're talking about his book, Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. Let's talk about Meredith Peterson. She's another great, great character and a person you seems like, again, you really liked, you had a good time hanging out with her. It was Patterson, I guess, right?
Did I say Meredith Patterson?
Patterson,
correct.
Yeah.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, she was fantastic. Now, this is a computer programmer and a linguist by training. Who lived in San Francisco when I found her. There was a sort of series of rumors among some of the very early emerging biohacking groups in Boston and San Francisco that there was this woman who in her kitchen with her own homemade DNA machinery was trying to insert the glow-in-the-dark plasmid, which comes from a jellyfish, into the bacteria that one normally uses to cultivate yogurt.
Right.
She wanted to create glow-in-the-dark yogurt, what she called glogurt. So I heard about her, and I found her, and I flew out there, and we spent a week together as she went through a number of different, efforts to try to insert the DNA inside the bacterium. The method we were using when I was out there was what was called electroporesis, which meant that, as she put it, we're going to taser them. which meant that we were going to apply 2,500 volts of electricity to the bacterium, which is about the amount that you apply in a death chair, let me just say, electric chair. So we were going to apply that much electricity to this little vial of bacteria. And at that time, it sort of like expands all the pore holes in the bacteria. So you can sort of shoot DNA inside of it when that happens. In my mind, I picture like some cartoon little bug sort of blowing up like a giant balloon,
right,
and then collapsing back down. Because we only zap them for like a couple of milliseconds. It's very, very short time. But anyway, so we were trying to set this thing up. And one of the things that was amazing is she had built her entire lab by herself.
Yeah.
So, instead of a centrifuge, she just had – originally she had like a salad spinner.
Right.
Her autoclave was like a just an incubator that she bought off of eBay for $30. Another thing that she used to keep things warm was an oven unit that you plugged into a cigarette lighter in an RV. Mm. There were just all these sort of like wonderful little cheesy hacks that she did that got exactly what she needed. The other thing you need to grow the bacteria is something called MRS broth. It's very expensive from the stores. She just went back and read the original article on it in some dairy magazine in 1956.
Wow.
Got the original recipe, made it herself. So what's cool about that is that, as we struggled to try to get this little plasmid inside this bacteria, we were failing constantly. But as I spent time with it, I realized like it never felt like failure.
Yeah.
In part because, there was nobody firing us from our job for not getting it right this time. In fact, each kind of error just pointed us ever closer to something that might work. And so one of the things that I talked about to her with her was her whole sense of what she considered failing. And she never really had a sense of ever failing, even when things just didn't work out. It was like, well, that was just more proof toward what will work out, right? And you can see how in a research lab where you're being paid, you can't afford that kind of cheerful attitude about error.
Yeah.
Right? You're going to be fired or you're going to be sidelined or someone else is going to take over your project. So it has to have this very narrow focus. Well, one of the pleasures of amateurism is just this kind of wide open sort of thing. By the way, she, in a side conversation, I must say, she really nailed my entire book in one line when we were talking about this kind of like fearlessness about failure. She said, hey, we're in a country where we wrote this constitution called the Articles of Confederation. It didn't work out so well. So we just trashed it and went out and wrote another one. Big whoop, she said.
Yeah.
And I love that. It's like, yeah, that's right. You know, we got the constitution all wrong and we rewrote it, got it right. And it was like, okay, moving on, you know?
Yeah.
That's the amateur impulse right there.
Well, and the other thing that you've learned when you were talking, you mean you went and met with, and we're not going to get to a lot of this, but, you know, these this 14-year-old robot inventor, and you discovered this thing that, this idea that the amateur as a loner, you know, this rugged individual, really was kind of a myth, that that wasn't really what was going on in these amateur
It's a total myth. It's the straw man that's always thrown up as in order to beat down the whole idea that amateurism does anything. Yeah, there are the amateur loners. I'll tell you who they are. They're the people who believe in perpetual motion, cold fusion, you know, these kinds of things, endless energy sources. Because you need sort of some kind of collaboration or some kind of newsletter or wiki entry or a club or something where you kind of knit your own sort of gonzo ideas in with something that in with other people who are real. Like right now, one of the bits of evidence that there's a kind of amateur resurgence right now is that these DIY workshops and these sort of synthetic biology labs are popping up all over the country, especially the DIY workshops. So I live in this very small town, really, New Haven, Connecticut, 125,000 people. We have a Maker Haven. We have a DIY workshop where you go and you pay, you know, a few bucks a month and you get access to this workshop. But what you really get access to is other people doing kind of what you're doing, or people that you can sort of turn to and say, what about this? Is this crazy? And they'll say, yeah. And so then you don't do that. In other words, you need that kind of collaboration, sort of keep yourself kind of even keeled as you head towards something really unknown and kind of crazy. And it's really easy to get lost. You know, everybody forgets, you know. Isaac Newton spent the last half of his life, you know, sort of, you know, exploring the outer edges of alchemy. That's right, alchemy. So it's very easy to get caught up in an idea that just, you know, we later find out just doesn't make any sense. And in fact, I think the reputation of the amateur crank as the kind of like loon who believes in perpetual motion or endless energy sources or cold fusion comes from the kind of the far out character who sees a little way too much out there at the cutting edge. And so the weekend club, also a great tradition in American history, right? Right now we're seeing these synthetic clubs are popping up all over, synthetic biology research clubs are popping up all over the country. And this is really the cutting edge, what Meredith Patterson is doing. This homebrew DNA bashing, as they call it, or, you know, biohacking or bioengineering. This is really the cutting edge of Americans' sort of youth technology right now. I suspect that this will become controversial at some point. There'll be some, you know, cable TV crisis about some suburban Jekyll kind of Dr. Hyde teenager creating weaponized Spanish flu or something in his suburban den.
Yeah.
And then we'll all freak out and everybody will start wetting their beds and the Homeland Security people and TSA or whatever bureaucracy it is now that the set of professional warriors, they will come crashing down on these people. But for now, what's interesting about these clubs is that they're trying to form the sort of rules of the road, the codes of ethics, the standards of behavior that one is going to – that one should use in pursuing this new science, right? And so in some ways, I think these clubs are like – this is the best version of this kind of cutting-edge technology. And by the way, we saw all of this with robotics, computers, you know, all the way back to amateur radio. Those were the clubs 100 years ago, right, that sort of domesticated this new technology in some way and made it, you know – appealing to the, you know, to the average American. It's hard to remember. It wasn't that long ago that when people talked about robots, it was actually kind of a slight terror that we were going to create something that was going to take over the world. Well, we might actually still get there.
Yeah.
But as I point out in my book, you know, Europeans who are like, they're very big on sort of like devising massive amounts of bureaucratic law. They just immediately went into like overdrive with this robotic law stuff. If you want to know about, if you want to know where the cutting edge of robotic law is, just go to The Hague or Brussels. You know, you'll they're just pumping out great reams of robotic law over there.
I want to come back around to Ben Franklin, and I loved the character of Claudine Lopez.
Yeah,
It's a great story. And I mean, she had this pretty tidy life and this promising future. And then she ends up, you know, going to France in exile and getting wounded and ending up in New York ultimately and working as this translator.
Right.
And you lay out the story, of course, and she sort of becomes the all-American housewife at Yale. Her husband works there and she's kind of miserable. But then she becomes this kind of amazing amateur historian and expert on the papers of Benjamin Franklin. And she gives us this new insight about Franklin in some ways. I mean, she sees him differently because of the fact that she's an amateur, I guess. Talk
totally.
About her, will you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, so she's a young girl who grew up in Belgium.
Yeah.
And on the eve of World War II, just as Hitler was invading Belgium,
yeah,
she was surprised to learn that she was a Jew,
right.
Something she didn't know as a young woman. And suddenly, you know, like overnight, she was supposed to go have this life as an academic and a teacher. And overnight, she's in a car, you know, racing to save her life. They get into France. They hide out there. And eventually they get to America. She falls in love with this professor who becomes, yeah, like you say, you know, an academic at Yale. But this is in the 50s. The best she can do is become a secretary. In fact, she doesn't even get that. The only job that they have for her in those days was something less than a secretary. It was a transcriber.
Right.
So she signed on to this thing called the Ben Franklin Papers. Now, in the early 50s, Truman had ordered that all the founding fathers' papers be, you know, centralized in one location and that scholars embark on this, like, you know, century-long annotation of all the papers so that we could all know who the, you know, exactly what all the founding fathers were and what they did. So, you know, UVA did, like, Jefferson, and Columbia did Hamilton, and Yale got Ben Franklin. And so they started this in the early 50s, and she was the transcriber because a lot of Franklin's later papers are in French, and she knew French.
Right.
And that's what the head guy had heard. And so she sat off by herself for decades doing this little bit of work. And she was not a scholar. She had no credential. But after 20 years of doing this, she realized that she was reading Franklin just a little differently than some of her older male colleagues. Mm. And one of the big finds that she made in one of her first books is that she just totally dismisses this idea that Franklin was this big lecher.
Yeah.
That he was constantly womanizing and boozing his way through every boudoir in France and all up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States. And, you know, she makes a really good case. Actually, Ben Franklin loved women, but he had this sort of flirtatious kind of encounter with women, a relationship with all women. But you know, many of the women that people say that he had an affair with, you know, he was encouraging them to marry.
Yeah.
He was trying to get them to go to college. I mean, he wanted to see their minds expand. And this was, you know, he was a kind of a mentor to everybody in the country at that time. Anyway, Claude Ann Lopez became one of the great Franklin scholars of our time. And it was all self-made. She never got a degree in anything. But her books are still widely, you know, regarded as, she's still with us. They're widely regarded as, you know, some of the great books on Ben Franklin. What's really cool about her is that, again, you know, because she was outside the sort of acceptable experience of traditional Franklin scholars, she just read all this stuff so differently than they did and saw things that they had never bothered to see, right?
Yeah.
Conventional wisdom is a kind of, you know, straitjacket. It makes you see things the way other people before you saw them. So Franklin, you know— Franklin really, to me, he bookends the whole book.
Yeah.
He opens and closes it, in part because I think he's an amateur in so many ways. Like I said, you know, the dropping out of his apprenticeship in Boston when he was a teenager is kind of the recreation of that long list of college dropouts that we all adore in this country.
Yeah.
Jobs, Zuckerberg, Gates, you know, you can go on Wikipedia and just type in list of college dropouts in America.
Right.
It's massive.
Yeah.
And you've heard of all of them because in some ways the sort of walking away from the official credential, the professional credential, and pursuing some kind of maybe cockamamie idea of your own is this essential Franklin idea.
Yeah.
In fact, some historians believe that the entire American idea of itself is a recapitulation of the whole Franklin narrative, the boy who ran away from Boston and went off to Philly and recreated this new version of Ben Franklin. Yeah. That in some way, all of us, no matter whether we're getting in Conestoga wagons and heading out west or walking out our back door to the garage, are in some ways redoing the essential Franklin story.
We're pretending.
And that's what makes us America.
Yeah. We're pretending. Yeah. I mean, that. And I like how you talk about this idea of that we're about play, too. I mean, this playfulness that comes with pretending that you talk about animates the amateur. Say something about that, if you would, finally, that, you know, it's about this idea of play is – because we invented playtime, and it was kind of radical, and
it's
that's
true.
So important.
It's still radical.
Yeah.
You know what the word in French for weekend is? It's le weekend. Because right. we invented this whole idea that, like, hey, work should end and we could go off and have fun, you know? That was like this crazy, you know, American concept. But also just the whole playful spirit in some ways and that idea of pretending. You know, people forget this, but most of Ben Franklin's characters that are most famous, Silence Duguid, mm-hmm. Polly Baker, these mm-hmm. are – he posed as middle-aged women in his writing. He pretended to be this other person in order to sort of, you know, tell these different stories and make us hear them. And there's something very, you know, that too is sort of part of the whole immigrant story of putting on a new hat, a new name, a new something. And amateurs, I think, very deeply feel that sense of pretending, almost like they almost feel like it's a kind of falsehood. Many of them are ashamed of it. That's why we love awards in this country, because we love anything that sort of, you know, sanctifies what it is that we're doing. But that sense of playfulness with Franklin is born in even his earliest images, the flying kite. Yeah. You know, the freedom that we still see in that image in Afghanistan is right there in Franklin from the beginning.
Jack Hitt, his book is called Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. He joined us today from a studio in Charleston, South Carolina. He's there to perform his solo theater piece. It's called Making Up the Truth. Jack, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Doug. It's great fun being here.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Thanks to Matthew Martin. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.